The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everyone. This morning, I'd like to talk about mindfulness. And I was reviewing the Buddha's main, or one of the Buddha's main teachings on mindfulness, the sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness this morning. And it struck me that the first thing he said in this text is why it's helpful. And I thought, that's a good place to start. Why do we do this? Just as a kind of a motivation, perhaps, for why we want to take this effort to cultivate mindfulness. And what he says is that mindfulness is the direct path basically to true happiness. That it's the direct path to releasing he uses the term the disappearance of sorrow and mental pain and grief. Basically, that the path to the letting go or the releasing of mental pain and grief is this practice of mindfulness. Now, the whole, you know, the Buddha in his whole journey, I'd say, the journey that he undertook when he started his practice was around this question of basically mental pain and grief. It was around the question of suffering. Why do we suffer? He looked around the world and he saw people, you know, suffering a lot. And his question was, is it possible to live and be truly happy, to be free from suffering? And so that was his exploration. And he chose to study this question by looking inside of his own mind and seeing, I guess to start with, one of his questions was, well, okay, there's suffering. What's my contribution? You know, what's this mind doing that's contributing to the problem here? And actually what he discovered is that that's really the whole of the suffering. We can kind of separate perhaps what the question of suffering, the mental pain and grief, from the fact that there is hunger, that there is pain when we get injured, the fact that there is basically a lot of unpleasant experience in life. And yet what the Buddha found in his own exploration is that unpleasant experience in life can simply be unpleasant experience, and that mostly what we mean when we say suffering is that we don't like unpleasant experience, we want to get rid of it. That we, when we have pleasant experience, we want to keep it. We want to hold on to it. And we're perhaps afraid that we're going to lose it. And so the suffering around our lives is largely in the terrain of how we respond, how we react to what's happening. And in fact, the Buddha found in his own exploration that with the releasing of reactivity to just what's happening in the present moment, with the releasing of reactivity, that there is a kind of deep peace, deep happiness that comes. Now, that deep peace and deep happiness doesn't mean that we don't act in the world. In fact, that kind of framing that we, you know, the kind of approach or the perspective that we gain with not reacting to the world, we are beings that move, that live, that respond. And as the reactivity begins to diminish, there's a natural responsiveness that starts to happen that is more motivated from compassion, from kindness, from wisdom, from generosity. And so it's not that this waking up and not being reactive means that we're not responsive to the world. And yet this exploration of how we react, this is a huge task for us to begin to understand that. And this is, you know, this is the training of mindfulness. And so the Buddha says in this statement, this is the direct path to true happiness, to the release of sorrow and mental pain and grief, to freedom, to peace, basically. These four foundations of mindfulness. And so mindfulness is pretty important if we actually want to have a true happiness, to not be in this kind of push-pull mode all of our lives. I think we see that, you know, we see that we're in a push-pull mode in our daily lives. We want to get this, we want to get rid of that, we're happy with this, oh, we're happy for a little while, oh, it changes, that one's no good anymore. Let me find something else. And so we're in this kind of push-pull, trying to find a stable place of happiness. And yet the very push-pull that we're doing is kind of keeping us from being in a stable place of happiness. And so the practice of mindfulness begins to help us to actually see what is going on in the present moment, what is actually happening right here and right now. And the Buddha found that in that letting go of that reactivity, the letting go of greed, the letting go of aversion, the opening to what's actually happening right here and now, which we could say as the letting go of delusion or the freedom from delusion, that there's a very deep kind of settledness and ease that happens in our lives when we're no longer in that push-pull mode. It's hard to envision from that perspective of being in the push-pull mode that there's any other way to live life. You know, we think that if we weren't in that push-pull mode that we would just be sitting around. I mean, what would we do if we didn't want things and if we didn't want to get rid of things, if we weren't in that reactive mode? Why would there be any reason to do anything? It takes a little bit of a leap of faith to enter into the terrain of letting go of reactivity and watch as a more skillful kind of responsiveness to the world begins to arise. And so the Buddha said mindfulness is the key, is the tool, is the path to this freedom, this happiness, this peace. And so what is mindfulness? I mean, we talk about it a lot, and we talk about practicing it a lot or cultivating it a lot. And what's kind of interesting, I mean, I've got a kind of working definition for it for myself, and I'll give that to you, that I would say is something along the lines of knowing what's happening while it's happening. Basically, there's an awareness of what's happening in the present moment while it's happening. Bhikkhu Bodhi, the translator of these discourses, this is the one of the key texts that describes some of the discourses the Buddha gave in his lifetime. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is a translator, one of the translators of this book. And his definition, his working definition of mindfulness is attention directed to the present moment. And so I think that's roughly what we think of when we think of mindfulness. And yet, the definition of mindfulness in this book It's not very clear. Kind of surprising in some ways when we, you know, think it's something he talked about. He said it was so important. It's not actually really defined. But what is talked about is how we establish mindfulness in a way that helps us to become free, helps us to find our way to the freedom from this reactivity. And so the sutta tells us that the discourse tells us how to establish mindfulness, but not really what mindfulness is. And so I'd like to look at, you know, thinking it, we can use that kind of working definition, but then let's look at what the Buddha said about establishing mindfulness. What are the factors we bring to establish mindfulness? How do we do this? And it's no big surprise. I mean, there's a couple of key words that are used in establishing mindfulness. One is attention. We attend to what's happening. And this, I think, is an important word with respect to mindfulness practice. And I think it's important to be clear that there's a difference between attention and mindfulness. At least my understanding is attention is the mind choosing to be aware of something. And so we can, for instance, right now, you can pay attention to the sensation of your hips touching the chair or cushion or bench. You can pay attention to the sensations of your hands. You can pay attention to the experience of your feet. You can pay attention to the experience of hearing. So, and you can also turn and pay attention to what mood or emotion you're experiencing right now. So we can choose to pay attention to something. And yet, if we're not choosing to pay attention to something, and if we're kind of lost in thought, if we're not mindful, if we're not cognizant in the present moment, using this definition of awareness directed to the present, or knowing what's happening while it's happening, it's pretty clear that we're not always aware in the present moment. We're often lost in thought. We're driving down the freeway and thinking about something that happened yesterday or what we're headed to, the meeting we're going to, and yet we're driving along and we're getting off the freeway at the right time and, you know, we're doing all that, but we are not consciously aware that we're doing all that. So there is, this is still the factor of attention at work. Our organism pays attention whether we're here for it or not. Our organism pays attention to the cars on the freeway. Our organism is paying attention to where the exit is. Sometimes we miss our exit if we're lost in terrible thought, but basically, there is a factor of attention at work, whether or not we're mindful. In fact, attention is said to be one of the aspects of mind that happens every single moment of experience. That whatever's going on, whether we're aware or not, whether we're mindful or not, the mind is paying attention to something. This factor of attention has a kind of an interesting quality to it. And this is where mindfulness comes in, I think. This is how it begins to shape, how we can begin to shape attention towards the establishment of mindfulness. Now think about the way we breathe. I'm going to use an analogy here. When we're breathing, we can consciously breathe. We can choose to say, I'm going to breathe in now and breathe in. And we can choose to breathe out And so the aspect of breathing, the experience of breathing, can be consciously controlled. We can choose to engage with it. Or if we're not engaged with it, the breath breathes itself. We don't stop breathing when we stop thinking about breathing. I just thought of this. This is kind of a non sequitur. But I thought I'd bring it in anyway because I thought it was an interesting bit of information. Whales, apparently, because of the way they live their lives, some underwater, some above the water, and they're mammals. They breathe air. They can't breathe underwater. Every single breath they breathe is done consciously. They choose. There's a choice that happens. There's not a kind of an automatic system that goes that keeps them breathing. It's an interesting thing to contemplate, a being that actually knows every breath it takes. Apparently, when because of that, they can't sleep in the way that we sleep. So half of their brain goes to sleep at a time, so that half of the brain can be awake to consciously breathe. But we have this capacity to either control the breath or not. And so there is this kind of interesting thing about breathing, that it can be consciously controlled. But if we're not consciously controlling, it's happening anyway. Attention is kind of like that too. We can consciously choose what to pay attention to. We can choose to pay attention to our breath or our hearing or the sensations of our feet or what our emotions are. We can choose to direct our attention to what's happening in the present moment. And we can choose to direct our attention in a way that we are recognizing this is happening in the present moment. And there's a difference we can also choose, for instance, and this is a key piece of how mindfulness becomes a pathway towards freedom. You know, we can also choose to pay attention to thinking, like, you know, we can, you know, okay, so yeah, I'm going to think about what happened yesterday, and we can kind of go into that world of, yeah, I'm going to think about what happened yesterday and reflect on that. But we can reflect on that in a way that we are engaged with the content and ideas of the thinking and are more interested in, you know, what we need to do about that content than we are interested in the fact that what's happening in the present moment is that there's thinking happening in the present moment. And this is a piece of our directing our attention to mindfulness, with mindfulness, directing our attention to the present moment of experience, that this sutta encourages us to know what's happening in the present moment as just something that's happening in the present moment. Over and over again, this is another word that's used a lot. Attention is used throughout the suttas as a support for mindfulness. And then another word that's used a lot in the sutta on the foundation of mindfulness is basically something like one knows or one understands. And it's used over and over again in different ways. When breathing in, one understands breathing in is happening. When breathing out, one understands breathing out is happening. When feeling something unpleasant, one understands something unpleasant is being felt. When experiencing confusion, one understands confusion is being experienced. When one experiences sleepiness, one understands this is sleepiness. So over and over again, the Buddha is pointing to just a very simple recognition of experience as phenomenon, experience as just simply something that's happening in the present moment. The sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness doesn't really talk so much about what to do about what you notice. In fact, it encourages just simply recognizing it. When breathing in, one understands breathing in is happening. When one experiences aversion, one understands aversion is happening in the present moment. One understands aversion is happening. The sutta does not say when one experiences aversion, when one recognizes aversion is happening, one should get rid of the aversion. It says one recognizes, one knows. So the emphasis in this sutta is around the recognition. This is the establishment of mindfulness. There's so much I can say about this topic. Decide where I want to go next. Why don't I see if there's any questions or comments right with that part? Great. Okay. I'll start with Bill and then John.
So I had an experience over the last 24 hours that seemed to encapsulate all of what you've described about mindfulness. It started with my losing my keys somewhere in the keys to the house and a church key. Now, this is not an ordinary church key. This is the master key to the church I belong to. So, anyhow, I lost them somewhere between three stores, and I had to cross the street between the three stores, so I'd walked a good distance, and I couldn't find them when I got home and wanted to open the door. So after, and then while trying to put the groceries away, I knocked a shelf out of the refrigerator and broke several bottles, so things were going very badly. A whole bottle of gherkins, a whole bottle of, or jar of gherkins and a jar of relish and some other messy things. So I went back and tried to retrace all my steps, and of course I didn't find the keys. And then I went home and had supper, and I decided I should meditate on my experience. That was probably the first inkling of mindfulness in this whole process. So
you
I meditated
on what you were experiencing in that moment.
More on where did I go?
Okay, so could I kind of improve my reflection?
Yes, reflection. Okay. Could I improve my memory of where I might have dropped the keys? So it did get me focused on one place, and that was the parking space in which I had parked, and from which I went to each of the three stores. And so I went back there this morning, and of course the keys weren't there. And then I decided, you know, if I had found those keys, I might have taken them not into the Safeway, which was nearby, but into the 24-hour fitness center, which was also nearby. And they had them. Some good Samaritan had turned them into their lost and found. And while meditating here this morning, I realized that the happiness I was experiencing at having recovered them and having benefited from someone else's goodwill had temporarily eliminated the fear, anxiety, guilt, shame, and anger that I had felt the evening before.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it seems to me my task could be to try to understand how to become aware of the guilt, fear, anger, etc. more frequently so that I would be happy not at having benefited from some special goodwill, but from just generally being aware of those feelings when they arise.
It is so counterintuitive to I mean, one of the things I think that happens as we start to establish mindfulness, you know, we start this practice. There are practices we explore to try to come into the present moment. You just talked about one, you know, reflecting back and being kind of aware while you're reflecting back. It creates a sense of, you know, presence and understanding of options, essentially, in that reflection. And, you know, other ones include being aware of the breath or being aware of our emotions or being aware of sound or being aware of just the flow of experience. So there's different, there's the establishment, what I understand the establishment of mindfulness as being is as we cultivate an attention directed to the present moment, as we cultivate that attention directed to the present moment, it begins to establish an awareness that is more of a sense of presence that then can be kind of, it's more of a state than it is a doing. What we do to establish mindfulness is to direct our attention. We may direct our attention to one thing, like the breath, or we may have a more general sense, kind of what feels like undirected attention. But we are, you know, like we are kind of, sometimes we can settle back and just kind of receive, you know, okay, there's sound right now, and there's body sensation right now, and there's dryness and coolness and tightness and happiness and confusion, and so it's just like we can be open, and yet what we're doing there is directing the attention to being here, you know, to being present. And as we start that exploration, as we start the practice of cultivating mindfulness, a lot of what we see is a bunch of mess in our minds. You know, we see the reactivity, we see the shame, we see the guilt, we see confusion, we see anger, we see so much that feels yucky. And, you know, sometimes it feels like, why do I want to do this? You know, why do I want to be mindful? Because it feels so bad when I do this. You know, it's like the mindfulness. And what the key to understanding and the key, I think one of the keys to faith here is that we start to see that mindfulness is not creating these reactive states of mind, but revealing them to us. They're there anyway. When we're not mindful of them, like your day yesterday, it was kind of like you were being driven by that shame and confusion and distractedness. You know, the story of like the refrigerator is a perfect example of that. I notice too when I get into a state where the mind is agitated about something, it's like it stops, like, you know, paying attention to how to move through space properly. And I do end up knocking things over or walking into, you know, corners of desks, and it's like, okay, the mind is agitated, so can I be aware of that agitation so that it's not, you know, leaking out into the way I'm engaged with the world? So it feels, you know, it feels so counterintuitive to start to wake up to the shame, the guilt, the confusion. And yet, you know, in some ways, and this is where the faith or the, you know, the sense of a leap of trust can come in. You know, wouldn't you rather know what's happening than just be kind of blindly driven by shame and guilt and confusion and anger and hostility and rage? And wouldn't you rather know? And, you know, the kind of, it seems like a paradox in a way that as we do start to wake up to those states, as we kind of get the confidence or the trust that it's useful to do that. As we get the trust that it's useful to, oh, shame's happening. This is what shame is like, as the Buddha suggests in the suttas. Like, not, oh, shame's happening, oh, I should feel really horrible, or I should, you know, go and, you know, somehow beat myself up about this. But shame feels like this. This is what shame feels like. The paradox of that is that in opening to what's those reactive emotions, a kind of a deeper wisdom begins to inform our experience. A deeper wisdom begins to help us, just as you know, saw, oh, maybe I could use my reflective attention to think about what might have happened. You know, so you know, that's kind of an inner wisdom that begins to shift and alter the landscape. So did you have something more you wanted to?
I was just going to say that I'll let you know when I find equanimity, so that whether I get the keys back or not, I've let go of all the fear, anxiety, anger, etc.
And John was next. There are a couple of, let me just see if there's a couple more pieces I wanted to say about that. So I think when we start, you know, this practice of establishing mindfulness, when we start that, a lot of what begins to be revealed is the way that we struggle. And so that's a lot of our work initially, is learning how to open to that. Whatever our ways of, we all have our favorite ways. We all have our favorite ways of getting caught and lost and confused. And one of mine was anger, you know, just like anger and aversion. It's like, oh, there's something here. Oh, get rid of that. Get rid of that. Get rid of that. If I can get rid of everything that I don't like, then I'll be happy. What we start to see as we cultivate this stability of mindfulness is that the whole movement of looking for what we don't like and getting rid of it creates the conditions for us to look for what we don't like so we can get rid of it. That's what it does. It doesn't create the conditions for ease and peace. It creates the conditions for more looking for what we don't like.
Thank you, Bill. I was driving to a shopping center to get some coffee, and then I parked my car and locked the door, and then I looked into my car seat, and there were my keys. Oh, that's nice. I wasn't unhappy. I was kind of funny. It was humorous. And then I remembered, oh, wait, I have my spare keys in my trunk. Well, that's not so good. So I finally got my keys. AAA is very good.
Oh, good.
I just thought it was really good. Anyway, I was interested in the question, the idea that you couldn't understand why Bhikkhu Bodhi couldn't understand the concept of mindfulness. You thought that was kind of strange. I think mindfulness is rather an abstract term. And you, as a mathematician, you are a math major, right? You've studied infinity. Think of infinity, and then you can kind of get the idea that it's really difficult to be mindful because it's like infinity. You can't grasp it. You can't hold on to it. Maybe you can, it's just a comment.
Yeah, it's not so much that I said that I thought it was strange that, what I said was I thought it was strange that the Buddha didn't define mindfulness in the sutta. He talked all around it. He talks how to establish it. He talks what we need to do to cultivate it, but he doesn't say what it is. And so that's what was my comment. Yeah, exactly. I mean, so I think, and so what? But what I want to say is that, you know, when the Buddha didn't define something, you know, it's kind of interesting. It's just like that. It's like, you know, it leaves a lot of room for the experience of it, rather than kind of pinning it down and saying, "Oh, this is what it is." And so that I think we need to take care with definitions of mindfulness. To say, oh yes, this is what it is. Yeah. So yeah, thank you for that. Any other comments? Or, yeah. And here's another mic if you want to use this one.
I thought it was interesting that when you...
There's a switch on the side.
I thought it was interesting that you used the verb attend when you were talking about focusing your attention. And that really resonated with me because I find when, you know, I'm meditating that it's easy to stay focused and not stay focused, but be present and be present with my thoughts. But then as I go along the day, of course, you don't sit and just observe, right? You are active. And so I thought the concept of a, you know, how you attend to things, how you attend to your children, or how do you attend to your experiences around you, and what that makes you do, like how you do it.
Exactly, yeah.
Is that really resonated? And I don't know if it talks about that in the sutras about, you know, attending. It's not about just having it, you know, I listen to your voice, I'm attuned to that voice, but it's also about that action that goes with it.
How, like, do we attend?
Correct.
How do we attend? Yeah. Yes, there is in fact another sutta, another one of my favorite suttas that gives a little description of what the Buddha called wise attention. And so my ears perk up with this. It's like, what is wise attention? You know, how should we attend to our experience? And to some extent, the entirety of the Sutta on the Four Foundations is a description of how we should attend to our experience in this way of, oh, this is what's arising. This is the experience that's happening right now. Another definition of wise attention is interesting. It says, when somebody attends wisely, they attend. This is suffering. This is the cause of suffering. This is the end of suffering. And this is the way leading to the end of suffering. That's a kind of a direct or orientation of using what we could call the framework of the Four Noble Truths as a way to orient how we pay attention to experience. In any moment of experience, there will be one of these four things happening. You know, either we are experiencing some kind of suffering, or we're aware of how that suffering is put together, or we're aware that actually there's a letting go of suffering happening. Or we're aware that there's a kind of a cultivation of wholesome qualities of mind. And like, you know, generosity or kindness or patience being cultivated. And so, you know, that's another way to talk about what wise attention is. The the question of orienting to, is suffering happening right now? You know, what is this? And again, to not have a reactivity about that, but, oh, this is suffering. This is what's happening right now. And then as we see, as we watch what's going on, we may watch a kind of a cycle or a transformation of that experience. This is one of the great joys of mindfulness practice, to watch the transformation of suffering while we are mindful. In one, I've seen this in so many different ways at so many different times. Basically, what the exploration is, to watch some, you know, to be mindful, to be aware of some struggle, you know, and maybe pick not so hard a one to start with. You know, maybe it's a little struggle like, oh, I dropped the jar of relish and I have to clean it up. You know, the kind of struggle around that, and you know, so to just watch, oh, the kind of the self, why did I do that or blah, you know, so just to be aware, oh, there's a kind of a self judgment happening now, you know, just watch what's going on, just watch that, and as you watch it, as mindfulness watches that, without additional judgment of, oh, I shouldn't feel self judgment or I shouldn't feel. You know, I shouldn't feel averse to this self-judgment, but just watches it. Just watch, oh, this is what's happening right now. The law of impermanence works in our favor when we just meet our experience with that kind of stability of mindfulness. And what we see is that reactivity when it's seen with that stability of mindfulness, reactivity doesn't have a lot of traction, and it will slowly at times, but it will diminish and even release. There are times with mindfulness practice, as mindfulness actually gets established, as there is a little bit more continuity, we can actually watch our reactivity and watch it end. On one retreat, I explored this around looking at wanting to look at people in walking meditation. And on retreats, we are often instructed to not look around much, to keep our attention kind of lowered, and, you know, just that looking around can add to distraction in the mind. And so I was really, you know, focused in that way. But there was a lot of wanting to look at things. And so I started just watching that wanting. You know, there was a conflict initially. It's like, oh, I want to look at things. I'm not supposed to look at things, so let me just, you know, force myself to not look at things. Well, that had the effect of my not looking at things, but it also created a struggle in the mind, created a sense of tension, of tightness, of I'm supposed to do this. This is the right way. This is the way to become mindful by not looking at things. It's like, what is that? You know, that's an idea. And so I began at some point after, you know, this was a 3-month retreat. So after a few weeks of like having my blinders on and basically not really noticing that I wanted to look at people. I knew I wanted to look at people, but that knowing that I wanted to look at people led to a reaction, force yourself not to look at people. Rather than really being aware, oh, not wanting to or wanting to look at people is happening right now. You know, that idea, that shift, it's like a little quarter turn in the mind, you know? It's just like a little slight subtle difference of what it means to be kind of caught by something and believing the importance of it and then recognizing, oh, this is just something happening in the present moment. And that's the direction of what the sutta says. Notice that this is what's happening in the present moment. And so I began looking at that. It's like, oh, wow. Wanting is, boy, what did wanting feel? Wow, it feels pretty powerful. It feels like a tractor beam. It feels like I'm being pulled to look at people. I didn't follow through on the wanting to look, but I really let myself feel, what does it feel like to want to look? That was a completely different practice than forcing myself to keep my eyes down. It was much more, it opened up a whole new world of exploration to do that kind of thing. And so I watched it. I watched the wanting. And I did this for, you know, 3 or 4 days watching this. And at some point, the mindfulness was established well enough that it watched the entire trajectory of the appearance of the wanting as somebody appeared in my field of vision, the strengthening of it as they got closer and closer to it just being like half a, you know, an inch to look up to look at them. It's like, you know, to really just watch that wanting and not follow through on it. It's like, there was a strong pull. So really feeling that pull to seeing the wanting vanish as the person went into a door, as the person disappeared and went into a door. It's like, phew, the wanting vanished. And in that moment of seeing the wanting vanish, that is seeing the ending of suffering, the ending. That's that third noble truth. That's the exploration of, oh, this is attending to the ending of suffering. And so we see that. That's a possibility that we can see that ending. And with that, so this wise attention, this is suffering, this is the cause of suffering, this is the end of suffering, this is the path leading to the end of suffering, we begin to learn a new kind of happiness. And I think this is really, that moment when I saw the wanting end was a very profound moment because it really felt like I'd been released from a vice grip. And I deeply understood in that moment how wanting, not just that wanting, but all wanting, is like a constriction and that being driven by that wanting is suffering. And that the release from that wanting, the release from that wanting is a different kind of happiness, a different kind of ease or peace that comes. And so the question of how do we direct our attention, you know, how do we attend to experience is really important. You know, that in the story, the difference between, oh, wanting is happening. I mean, aware that I wanted something, but, you know, I wanted to look at people, but the initial thing was, oh, I want to look at people, don't do that. You know, forcing myself to not look. And then the way the Buddha is suggesting we actually attend is to be interested in that experience itself. Oh, this is what wanting is. So that's a huge exploration, and we can attend to things in so many different ways. So another tool in our toolkit is to check in from time to time, you know, essentially, while we are attending to something, you know, what's the relationship to how we're attending to it? Am I attending to it with a relationship of kind of stickiness of wanting to have it or hold on to it, or is it a relationship of aversion, which is very much one of my patterns? You know, it's like, don't want this. How can I control experience so I don't get caught by that, which is really what my mind was doing around that, wanting to look at people, as I was controlling my experience, as opposed to being interested in the experience and being mindful of the experience. So, you know, the attention can be directed in a way that kind of hooks us into the habitual patterns, or it can be directed in a way that begins to support a release from those habits and patterns. So that's a huge exploration, how we attend. And yet, one of the interesting things that starts to happen, you know, so the how we attend, attending in a skillful way, attending in the way it's suggested in the Satipatthana Sutta around just being aware, oh, if wanting has happened, know that wanting is happening. If aversion is happening, know that aversion is happening. Or through this lens of suffering, cause of suffering, end of suffering, path leading to the end of suffering. You know, directing our attention in this way begins to establish mindfulness. But mindfulness is not attention. And this is something I think that's important to recognize, because the more the mindfulness is established, using this skillful approach to establishing it, the less we have to try to attend in a specific way. The state of mind becomes established. It becomes like the way we attend without having to do it so much. And so that's where the mindfulness becomes really powerful. But we have to direct our minds that way in order for the mindfulness to get established in that way. So, you know, we need to start with this effort to be aware and to use our attention in skillful ways. But a key piece, too, though, is to not confuse the practice for establishing mindfulness with mindfulness itself. I think this is an important piece. I think sometimes people do confuse this, that, for instance, we can establish mindfulness by paying attention to the breathing. And then people confuse the paying attention to the breathing with what the goal is. The goal is more the establishment of this state of mind that can be present, that can know what's happening in the present moment. And with that establishment, we begin to, I would say that with that establishment, wisdom begins to really get strong. The wisdom of what actually leads to happiness and what keeps us caught. You know, that wisdom of recognizing, you know, actually acting on getting rid of what I don't want doesn't actually lead to happiness. That's a form of wisdom. And that the establishment of mindfulness begins to have that wisdom become more, it kind of grows from the inside as opposed to being something that we're telling ourselves from the outside. That, you know, it's like at one point I was watching anger for months, watching, you know, anger come and watching how I experienced it and watching, you know, the impact it had on my body. And, you know, I was just watching it. And at one point, I saw, just after several months of watching it and getting really, really, really familiar with the experience of anger in my mind, at some point, the mind watched. I mean, I was just, you know, this is kind of a place where mindfulness apparently happened to be established. I cannot take credit for mindfulness being established in this moment because, as far as I was concerned, I was just cutting an apple in the kitchen. I was just, you know, doing my thing, cutting an apple in the kitchen. And yet I'd been really working with being aware of anger. And what happened is that I became aware of a thought in the mind connected to the person that I was experiencing so much anger around. It's kind of like the way I see it now is that I had become so attuned to how this particular anger arose that it was like, as one teacher says, I got to know the smell of it coming. You know, the thought of this person that I was angry with kind of woke me up. It's like, oh yeah, terrain of anger here. You know, so it's like the mind kind of woke up in that moment and watched the kind of momentum towards anger in that moment. The thought of the person that I was angry with arose, and I watched the mind go, oh yeah, let's get angry at that person. But having really felt and really experienced the suffering of the anger, the mind did not choose to pick up that thought. And again, so this is like the wisdom in that moment was that the mind knew that leads to suffering. The mind let it go. I didn't actually try to say, oh, the mind is heading to suffering, maybe I should stop thinking that thought. It happened automatically because the establishment of mindfulness and the wisdom that way lies suffering was right there. From having practiced and cultivated the awareness of, oh, this is what it's like to be angry. Now, even that one simple practice, that was in the first, you know, 3 or 4 months of my practice, that one simple practice really helped me to understand just how this practice works and to give me the confidence that, wow, looking at my, you know, I had spent several months thinking, wow, this is really unpleasant. Boy, anger, blah, I don't like this. You know, why do I want to do this? But kind of taking it on faith. And that moment, really seeing how and why mindfulness works. So, you know, the establishment of mindfulness really allows it to be a powerful force in our lives, a very powerful force in our lives for heading us towards the letting go of reactivity. Well, that was quite a long response to your question. And it's time to stop. So thank you.